welcome to the December edition of the Astropod. Once again, it's another Christmas cracker of an edition, and as always, I'm Quinton Goddard.
And I'm Maciek Hermanowicz.
That's right, listeners. Please don't be scared, but Anna isn't here this month. She's away with her husband in some other country. Well, the good news is we've got Maciek in. So Maciek, welcome to the show.
Hello there, glad to be on the team.
It's great to have you. Maciek, as you're new to the show, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, my name is Maciek. I'm Polish. I'm currently doing my first year PhD at the IOA, working with Rob Kennicott.
That is a good choice of supervisor, Maciek, and he's my supervisor as well. I'm sure you'll have a great time. Now, for those of our listeners who enjoy our public outreach activities on Wednesday evening, we're taking a two-week break, but fortunately, we'll be back on the 6th of January 2010, and you can come along to the IOA as normal at 7 o'clock and listen to John Eldridge, who's talking about science in science fiction. And this is one of those talks which is suitable for children 8 years and older, so please do come along.
So while we are taking a break from the outreach activities, you can do some other fun stuff, such as send your name to Mars by going onto marsparticipate.jpl.nasa.gov and filling in your details. There's a project run by NASA where you can submit your name. That will then be launched onto Mars together with the Mars Science Laboratory mission, which is scheduled for launch in 2011, arriving at the Red Planet at 2012.
Well, Maciek, it sounds fascinating. I'm sure I'd love to have my name on Mars, or perhaps even a crater named after me, something important like that. But what's the Mars Science Laboratory actually going to do whilst it's on Mars?
So Mars Science Laboratory is the newest rover, the biggest of the lot sent to Mars so far. It's going to roam around the surface doing geological surveying of any interesting rocks, also looking for traces of life on the surface of Mars in different chemicals. But I believe the coolest bit of equipment on board is a laser which can vaporize a bit of a rock from up to 9 meters, and then a spectrometer is going to check the composition of the cloud which results after this zapping. So this sounds like pretty cool Star Wars scheme to me.
It does sound like we've got a massive, gigantic robot machine walking around working out what the Martian landscape is made out of. Sounds like a great project.
Yes, it is.
Now, listeners, I've got some more sad and upsetting news for you. Laura Churcher, who normally reads our news section, is not reading the news section this month. Don't worry, she's fine. She's just gone home early for the Christmas holidays. Fortunately, though, Joe Wormswell has agreed to step into Laura's shoes and read the Astro News for us this month. Now, Joe, much like Maciek, is another new first-year PhD student, and it's really great to have some new, fresh talent on the show. So here he is with the Astro News. Over to you, Joe.
Hello and welcome to this month's Astro News with me, Joe Wormswell. NASA's WISE satellite launched. On Monday the 14th, NASA succeeded in launching the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, WISE, into a polar orbit. It will perform a full sky survey in the infrared, building up a detailed picture of infrared sources in every direction. The last complete infrared survey by the Infrared Astronomical Satellite was performed 26 years ago, and detection technology has greatly improved since then. As WISE is observing infrared radiation, it must be cooled to a very low temperature, or the infrared emission from its own heat would obscure anything produced by the rest of the universe. Frozen hydrogen is stored aboard WISE and prevents the temperature of the detectors from rising above minus 266 degrees Celsius. Unfortunately, the hydrogen coolant cannot be prevented from escaping. This means that WISE is expected to fail in around 10 months' time from overheating. In that time, it will spend 1 month being calibrated and readied for its task, 6 months performing the full sky survey, and then another 3 months resurveying about half the sky again. WISE will be looking at some very nearby objects, the asteroids and comets that pass near to the Earth. It will provide information about their composition and size, as well as telling us if they are likely to collide with the Earth in the near future. WISE will also be looking at some very distant objects, such as young galaxies with high levels of star formation or supermassive black holes. These are often shrouded in dust and hence emit little visible light. Other likely discoveries include brown dwarfs, failed stars that are too small to begin hydrogen burning. These also emit little visible light and are much easier to detect in the infrared. Super-Earth planets discovered around two nearby sun-like stars. The first of these is 61 Virginis, only 28 light-years away and visible to the naked eye in the constellation Virgo. It is a G-dwarf star, like our own Sun. By looking for changes in the star's radial velocity over a period of several years, an international team of astronomers were able to deduce the presence of three planets with orbital periods of 4.2, 38 and 124 days, and with masses of 5.1, 18.2 and 24 Earth masses. The innermost and smallest planet falls into the super-Earth category, as although it is several times larger than the Earth, it is still much smaller than gas giants like Jupiter or Neptune. The second star to have a super-Earth is HD 1461, another G-dwarf 76 light-years away. It has one planet with a period of 5.8 days and a mass of 7.4 Earth masses. This is very interesting, as before this, no super-Earth planets had been found orbiting G-type stars. Most known exoplanets are gas giants. It brings us closer to the goal of discovering Earth-like planets around Sun-like stars, although technology will need to improve before planets as small as the Earth can be easily detected by this method. Unfortunately, both these super-Earths are orbiting too close to their stars to be habitable. However, similar planets around cooler M-type stars would be within the habitable zone and could be detected in the near future. Mercury map ready. Cartographers at the US Geological Survey have completed their map of the surface of Mercury. It is a composite of the data from the Mariner 10 mission in the 1970s, and the more recent flybys of Mercury by the MESSENGER probe. MESSENGER will return to Mercury in March 2011, and hopefully manage to go into orbit. A good map is important to make sure that its instruments are pointed at the most interesting features. The map will also be useful when the joint European-Japanese probe, BepiColombo, arrives at Mercury in 2020. Of course, all the new surface features that have been discovered will now have to be named. The internationally agreed naming convention requires that for Mercury, craters be named for artists, painters, musicians and authors, escarpments for the ships of explorers, plains for the name given to the planet Mercury in various languages, and valleys for radio telescopes. Hopefully the supply of these names does not run out. That's all for this month's Astro News, and goodbye from me, Joe Wormswell.
Interesting stuff there, Joe. I was very interested to hear about the sort of naming scheme for features on Mercury. I mean, craters always named after artists and painters. I mean, just how good an artist or a musician do you have to be to get a crater named after you?
Well, I just guess that the crater size you would get is going to be proportional to your popularity.
Well, that's a very scientific approach, Matchek. But I would reckon in about 10 years' time, I think craters are going to be sponsored by people. You'll see the X Factor crater on Mercury. It'll be fascinating and scary at the same time.
I guess so. Also, with the ridges named after explorers, well, that could make having Beagle on top of Britney Spears possible.
An interesting combination indeed. So, Magic, I hear we found another super-Earth planet?
Oh, yes, we did, in fact. There's the first super-Earth with a potential atmosphere has been discovered by a group led by David Charbonneau. His group discovered a planet which is roughly 6 Earth masses and 2.7 Earth radii. Now, the problem is, when they compared it to the current models of planet, it turned out that the planet's just too large. So it has to have a 200 kilometers thick, very dense atmosphere, which would account for a larger observed size of the planet during the transit.
So this is a very heavy planet, but with a big, big atmosphere.
Yes, indeed. The atmosphere of that planet is estimated to be thicker than the atmosphere of Venus, and that is enough to crush a tank if it would be placed on the planet's surface.
So this isn't my next extraterrestrial holiday destination, is what you're telling me?
Well, if you want to go back home to tell the story, definitely not.
Dangerous places to visit. Well, moving on, I think it's time for the interview section.
So who are you interviewing this month, Quincy?
Well, Matchek, this month, because it's a Christmas edition, I thought it might be nice to take a look inside the Astropod itself and try and talk to the people who help make this show what it is, because I don't think the listeners realise just how many people make up the show. So my first guest today on the interview section is Matt Bothwell. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Hi there, Quincy.
So, Matt, well, we don't often hear you on the show because you're our, well, normal sound engineer for the show. So what exactly is it that you do for the Astropod?
I normally take your incoherent ramblings and piece them together into something that's suitable for public consumption.
Some would say that's a mammoth task.
I know that more than anyone else, Quincy.
Certainly is. So you're a PhD student here. In fact, we've got the same supervisor, well, for most of the time, Rob Kennicott. But what is it exactly that you do for your PhD?
Well, I'm doing a PhD in two halves, really. My supervisor is Rob Kennicott for one half of my PhD, and I'm looking at star formation in the local universe, looking at the connection between gas content of galaxies and their star formation rates. And I'm also doing a half a PhD with Scott Chapman, where I'm looking at very extreme high redshift systems at the back of the dawn of the universe.
So it sounds like you've got two very different projects.
Well, hopefully, I'm hoping to tie it all together at the end. It's a similar theme running through them both, which is the connection between the gas content and the star formation rates of these galaxies.
Okay, so when you're making these measurements in the local universe and the high redshift universe, how does that compare? I mean, you can't use the same observations, I guess.
No, we can't at all. So in the local universe, we use optical wavelengths and sometimes infrared light. And at high redshift, we have to rely on radio waves to give us that information.
So I'm assuming that as a very general trend, the more gas content you've got in your galaxy, the higher the star formation?
Yeah, that's right. That's if you look within the galaxies, and you can look at more specific things like how the gas is distributed and how dense it is as well.
Okay, so you can begin to see changes through different galaxy types as well, I imagine.
Yeah, that's the idea, yeah.
Well, Matt, you're now in your penultimate year of your PhD. Do you have any major conclusions for us yet?
Well, I guess I've got a whole host of conclusions. One of the most important ones is that in these very extreme systems called submillimeter galaxies at high redshift, stars are being formed much more efficiently than we would think otherwise. So there's a lot more stars being formed for the amount of gas than we see in anything in the local universe.
A bit of an erroneous result, I imagine.
I'm not sure if it's erroneous. It's very interesting. It kind of hints that there are different modes of star formation going on throughout the history of the universe. Raised a lot of questions.
Good stuff. Well, good luck with the PhD, Matt. And I think I'll bring on my next guest. So my next guest is Jane Birkby. Jane, you're the producer of the AstroPod. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Quincy.
So Jane, producer is a, you know, often strange and misunderstood term. What exactly is it that you do for the AstroPod?
Well, Quincy, my job consists mainly of getting all you guys together to do some recording, putting everything together and making sure that you don't say anything that is offensive or unerrable for the podcast.
Some would say that's your toughest job.
Yes, I would say so. It's challenging.
Some would say your most important job, though, is trying to organise myself and making sure I get the interview ready each month. So, Jane, let's move on to your PhD research. You're a third-year PhD researcher, much like Matt was. Just tell us a little bit about your research.
Well, Quentin, I am a planet hunter. I look for the small bodies that orbit other stars beyond our solar system.
So are you looking at any particular stars?
I have a bias towards low-mass stars. These are cool stars, and they're called M-dwarfs, and they're about half the mass of our own star.
So why would you want to try and look for planets around these low-mass stars?
Well, the method that I use to do this, called the transit technique, is actually much easier to do when the star is much smaller, because the planet itself is relatively bigger and blocks, percentage-wise, more of the light coming from the star.
So this is looking for planets that pass in front of stars in our field of view?
Yes.
Okay, so have you managed to find any planets yet?
I have plenty of candidates, Quincy, but no confirmations yet, I'm afraid.
I'm sure it's pretty tough to find these planets.
They are, it's very difficult.
So you have to look at thousands of stars, I imagine, just to find, you know, some kind of dip in the amount of light you're receiving. How do you then, like, follow those observations up and actually confirm a planet?
Well, what we do is we use a variety of telescopes, and we do two different techniques. One is to get really good light curves, so taking images of the star every couple of minutes to see how its brightness changes. And we also follow up using something called the radial velocity technique, for which we use a spectrograph.
It certainly sounds like a very instrumentation and sort of data-heavy PhD.
It is indeed. It's very observational, but I like it. It allows me to go to Hawaii and La Palma, so...
Good times. So are you hoping to find a few planets before your PhD finishes?
I hope so.
Well, good luck, Jane. And now let's bring on my third guest. So, Joe, you're my next guest on the show. We introduced you earlier on. So, have you enjoyed working on the AstroPod for the first time?
Yes, it's been very enjoyable.
So, Joe, you're a first-year PhD student, so I won't sort of dig down too deep into what you're doing as you're just getting to grips with everything. So, who's your supervisor?
Well, my supervisor is John Eldridge, but unfortunately he will be leaving us at the end of this year, this academic year, so I will be supervised by Chris Stout after that.
So what exactly are you going to be looking into over the course of your three-year PhD?
Well, my PhD is in stellar evolution, using the Cambridge Stars Code. So the project I'm working on at the moment involves looking into blue loop evolution, which is a phase in the evolution of stars somewhat larger than our own sun, so between 5 and 15 solar masses. And when they start burning helium in their core, they heat up considerably and become bluer. Now, this is well observed, but unfortunately our code doesn't explain it particularly well. So it's my job to try and include a bit more physics in the program and make it reflect reality better.
So this is very much a sort of theoretical modelling project.
Alas, yes, it means I spend my day wrestling with recalcitrant code and trying to get it to work properly, rather than flying off to exotic destinations. But I suppose it's my fault entirely.
Well, I think the nice thing about PhDs is it allows you sort of time to move about, and I'm sure once you get your code working, there'll be chances to go and try and compare your theoretical predictions to observations. So
let's hope so.
Well, thanks very much. Let's crack on with my fourth guest. Dan Wilkins, you're my next guest on the show. You're our new sound engineer. How are you finding the AstroPod?
I'm enjoying it, actually. Censoring bits of your banter, making it suitable for public audience.
Has Matt Bothwell been training you well?
Yes, indeed he has.
That's great. So you're one of our new first-year PhD students. And who are you working with?
I'm working with Andy Fabian in the X-ray group here at the IOA.
Ah, the infamous X-ray department. Very well known and well respected. So what exactly are you going to be researching over your PhD?
So I'm interested in active galactic nuclei, or AGN, and this is where you have a supermassive black hole at the centre of a galaxy accreting, that's taking on a lot of matter and giving out huge amounts of energy in the form of visible light all the way through up to X-rays.
So these are exceptionally, exceptionally bright objects.
Yes, they're some of the most luminous objects in the universe.
Okay, so what exactly are you studying about these AGN? Because I think they're very well researched and there's lots of physics going on in these objects, obviously.
Okay, so my main interest is actually looking right down at the centre of the system, at the accretion flow around the black hole. So there's a lot still unknown about this. So the way we think these work at the moment is you have some source of X-rays somewhere above the disk, and this then shines down onto the disk, giving us a reflection back. And I'm trying to find out how much reflection we get from each little bit of the disk. And once we've got that, this will allow us to answer all sorts of interesting questions. So part of this, it'll allow us to trace the way the light travels around the black hole, which will give us more tests of Einstein's theory of general relativity. But also, it'll give us information about the geometry of the disk and the structure of the flow. So this should allow us to find out how this matter is actually swirling into the black hole.
So really trying to track matter and work out the physics of the black hole very close to black holes.
Yes. So it's very strong gravity regime here.
So, well, good luck with the rest of the PhD, Dan.
Thanks
a lot. I hope it goes well. And let's bring on my fifth guest. Well, this is a man that needs no introduction. Welcome back to the show, Maciek.
Hello there.
So, Maciek, we've already done a brief introduction about you, and, well, obviously you're one of the co-hosts of the show now. So let's try and talk about your PhD research. What exactly are you going to be looking at?
I'm going to be looking at star formation in the local universe, much like Matt is. Obviously, at this stage of my PhD, everything is quite a bit open-ended. At the moment, I'm just teaching myself and getting familiar with all the relevant observational techniques necessary.
Well, I think that's the nice thing about PhDs, is that it is much more of a sort of open-ended story. There's no one fixed question you're ever trying to answer.
Oh, yes, indeed. And you never know where your research is going to take you. And that's the beauty of it.
Well, Maciek, I'm sure you'll have a great time doing your PhD, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you very much.
So let's get on with my sixth guest. Another gentleman that needs almost no introduction is Alex. Welcome back, Alex.
Hi, Quincy.
So, Alex, you're normally reading the Sky at Night section. I mean, how do you find the sort of Sky at Night section for the AstroPod?
Well, this is largely done from online sources. And basically, there are several key websites which I regularly search, and then I collate all the information together into one nice bite-sized chunk for the AstroPod.
Do you find yourself ever listening to your own advice and going out and observing the things you talk to us about?
Yes, I do try, actually, to see the meteor showers, since they are obviously best viewed with naked eye.
So, Alex, you're a second-year PhD student. What exactly is it that you study?
I am studying a early period in the universe's history, which is called reionization. I'm doing this with George Becker, and it involves looking at very high redshift galaxies, which basically corresponds to within the first billion years of the universe being born.
So you talk about very early on in the universe in this period of reionization. What exactly was happening in the universe at this time?
Okay, so after the Big Bang, you had a very, very hot universe where all of the hydrogen gas was fully ionized. Then a bit later on, approximately 380,000 years later, the universe cools down to a sufficiently low temperature that the electrons that are flying around are caught by the atoms and you get suddenly fully neutral hydrogen. That's known as recombination. That's where the cosmic microwave background comes from, the radio echoes of the Big Bang. And then you have all this neutral hydrogen gas, and some of that starts to form the first stars. And some of those stars are very big, very hot, and so they have lots of energy. They give out light with lots of energy, which manages to ionize the surrounding gas. And eventually, over time, the stars ultimately ionize all the hydrogen gas in the universe, and you end up with the universe that is today, which is fully ionized. So the period where it's going from being fully neutral to fully ionized is called reionization.
So this is probably the last big phase change the universe underwent.
Yes, yes. This is very fundamental as well to many ideas and theories of galaxy formation, as the way in which matter clumps together is very much dependent upon the temperature of the matter, and ionization heats up the gas. So depending upon whether or not reionization was fast or slow really has a big impact on how quickly and how easily big galaxies can form in simulations. And it's very hard to sort of match with observations at the moment.
So are you looking at this from a theoretical standpoint?
I'm doing, actually, my PhD should be 50-50, hopefully. So there's a lot of work with simulations and then going out and looking at observations of some of the most distant objects known in order to try and work out whether or not we are looking at a realistic simulation.
Well, Alex, sounds like it's really fundamental stuff, and best of luck with it.
Thank you.
Well, unfortunately, listeners, we've now descended to the 7th level of astronomy hell, and I have to invite back to the show Michelle Collins. Welcome back, Michelle.
Thanks, Quentin.
Now, Michelle, you're normally in charge of the astronomy joke of the month. Just how do you come up with such interesting jokes?
Well, Quentin, it takes hours of research, dedication and creativity and Google.
I see. That's, yes, scary. Well, let's try and talk about your PhD. What exactly is it that you research?
So I'm working on, well, in a field known as local group cosmology. And it's basically looking at galaxies that are very nearby, such as either the galaxy we live in, the Milky Way, or our neighbouring large spiral galaxy, Andromeda. And also all the smaller galaxies that live in and around the halos of these large objects.
So what are you trying to find out about what's called the local group of galaxies?
Well, the idea is you study the halos of large galaxies such as M31 and the smaller galaxies within them, and you can build up an archaeological picture of galaxy formation. So in the halo, they hold on to information that's brought in by other galaxies that are merging with these galaxies and making them bigger.
So effectively what you're doing is a sort of galactic archaeology, trying to deconstruct the history of these galaxies.
That's exactly right. So we're looking at the remnants of these building blocks of these galaxies, just to see how they built up over time. So, you know, what objects came in first, what objects came in later, and how these different objects end up being arranged into the galaxy you see today. So what created the disk, what created the halo, what created the bulge, and so forth.
It's quite an interesting PhD, because normally when we look at the sky, we sort of see a very static picture. So it must be fascinating to sort of delve into the history of these galaxies.
It really is, and there's a lot you can do with just looking sort of at one large galaxy. So I focus mainly on M31, and the team I'm involved with has done a giant survey, and if you put all this picture together, you can get a very accurate sort of idea of the timeline of the evolution of the galaxy.
So are there any interesting or surprising results you and your team have come up with so far?
Well, one thing that we have found out quite recently is that it appears that the building blocks of the galaxy M31, Andromeda, are different from those that built up our own galaxy. So we can observe some of the oldest galaxies known are dwarf spheroidal galaxies, and they live in the halos of these larger objects, such as the Milky Way and Andromeda. And you can look at the halos of these objects and the stars within the halos. And what we can see from comparing the two populations around our galaxy and around M31 is that the ones in M31 appear to be much less dense than those in our galaxy, and that's not really well understood at the moment.
So really more questions to go and find out answers to.
That's correct.
Well, Michelle, best of luck.
Thank you.
And then my final guest, and perhaps the hardest one for me to interview, is myself. So I have dragged back in Jane, who's going to ask me some questions about my PhD.
Yes, listeners, it's the moment you've been waiting for. What exactly does Quentin Goddard do? So, Quentin, who do you work for and what do you do?
Well, Jane, I work with Rob Kennicott, and I believe sort of several people on the Astropod work with Rob as well. So I'm looking at a class of galaxies which have what's called extended ultraviolet disks. This is looking at spiral galaxies which have a lot of stars forming in the disk. And when you look at them in the ultraviolet, you begin to see a lot of sort of little ultraviolet dots very far away from the main structure of the galaxy. And these little tiny ultraviolet dots have a lot of stars forming in them in areas which are very far away from the galaxy. And this is a very surprising phenomenon. So it's my job to go and research these objects.
And what have you found out about these objects?
Well, it's quite interesting, actually. About a year ago, I thought I had a sort of single answer for why stars were forming so far away from the galaxy. And it had to do with galaxies interacting with one another. And when they do, they sort of stir up the gas in the sort of disk of these galaxies. And that can promote star formation. Mm-hmm. But recently, I've been looking at a new object. And this doesn't actually have any interacting partners at all.
Okay.
Which means there's probably more than one trigger for this kind of phenomenon, which is quite interesting in itself.
So how do you go about taking observations of these objects, Quentin?
Well, to look at these objects, you really sort of want to get a picture of what stars make up these tiny ultraviolet objects sitting very far away from the galaxy. And to do that, you've got to take many, you know, many observations in different wavelengths. So if you look in the optical, you get a picture of the very, very high mass stars that are in these objects. If you look in the ultraviolet, you get a picture of stars that are quite high mass, but not quite as big as the optical ones.
When you say high mass, what kind of matter?
So for the optical light, we're really talking about very, very massive stars. So ones that are 10 solar masses or bigger.
Okay.
And the ultraviolet, that's contributed from stars that are about 5 solar masses and larger. So when you compare these two observations, you begin to get a picture of the sort of ratio of high mass stars to medium mass stars that are in these objects. And then you can combine that with what's called spectra. So when you take the light from the object and you break it down. And when you do that, you can begin to get very good ideas of the sort of metals that are in these objects as well. So how much oxygen there is, how much carbon there is, how much sulfur there is, and so on. And when you combine all this information, you begin to sort of construct an idea of how you think these objects have gotten there, how long they've been there for, what stars are forming now, what stars used to be there, and all kinds of information, really.
That sounds like fascinating stuff, Quentin. So you're in your final year now. How's the thesis writing going?
It's getting there, Jane, very slowly. I'm trying to sort of put the papers I've written into a thesis format, which is a very difficult process.
Well, good luck. I hope it goes well.
Thank you, Jane. Well, thanks very much for interviewing me, Jane. And I'd like to thank all my guests on this Christmas edition of the Astropod. I hope you listeners have enjoyed sort of learning a little bit more about everyone that works on the Astropod. Now, on a side note, Maciek, are you a Frank Sinatra fan?
Somewhat, yeah. Why?
Well, I used to be a fan of the song Fly Me to the Moon. You familiar with the song?
Yes, indeed I am. I'm not going to hum a tune, though.
Thank you, Maciek. Well, it was my favourite song until I found out that the moon is, in fact, the coldest place in the solar system.
Oh, is it?
Well, apparently so.
I was always convinced that the CERN people claim to have the coldest place in the solar system.
Well, I think that
there.
Would certainly classify as the coldest man-made place in the solar system. But apparently NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter has just found an exceptionally cold crater on the moon's surface.
How cold is it there?
Well, they've recorded temperatures as low as 26 degrees Kelvin. Yes, brr indeed. Now, the moon has a very, very sort of tiny, tiny tilt on it, which means that at the poles, just at the poles, you actually get some seasonal variation. And they found this unbelievably cold temperature at the edge of the Hermite crater, which is near one of the poles. So yes, exceptionally cold in a very, very shady crater. But dangerous places to visit.
Fair enough.
Well, that's all we've got for you now. Now we're going to move on to the Sky at Night section with Alex.
Up in the skies this holiday season, hopefully some of you were able to catch the Geminid meteor shower, peaking at 5 a.m. on the morning of the 14th of December, with a rate of 100 meters an hour. The Geminids are extremely unusual in that they originate from the dust trail of the asteroid Phaeton, rather than a comet. It is unknown how an asteroid can produce meteoroids, but it is believed that this chunk of rock, 3 miles across, was formerly the core of a comet that had been baked dry. Don't worry if you missed it though, as luckily at this time of year there is another one just round the corner. A traditionally faint shower, the Ursids will peak with a rate of 10 an hour at 7 a.m. on the 22nd of December in Ursa Minor for those with a keen eye and who love a challenge. The Quadrantids meteor shower is much more observer friendly and will peak at about 7 p.m. on January the 3rd, with potentially up to 100 meters an hour seeming to radiate from near the tail end of Ursa Major, also known as the Big Dipper, in an area of the sky that was the now disused constellation Quadrans Mirales. If you're out early in the evening on New Year's Eve, you may be lucky enough to glimpse a very partial lunar eclipse, with mid-eclipse at 7:23 p.m. the Earth's shadow will just catch the bottom right corner of the moon, and so at that time it may seem a slight red colour, although it's such a weak one that it'll be hard to see anything half an hour either side of the mid-eclipse. Incidentally, this will also be a blue moon by the modern definition, in that it's the second full moon within a calendar month. Sunday, December 20th at 5:30 a.m, Jupiter and Neptune are in conjunction, which means that they are in exactly the same compass direction on the sky, roughly southwest, and will be separated by about the width of a finger at arm's length. On December 21st, the moon enters the same field of view, and all three will be close together, although it will be hard to see Neptune with the glare of the moon. Mars is 11 arcseconds wide and growing in size, with its north polar cap nicely visible if you observe southwards in the early hours of the morning. It will be at opposition, meaning closest to the Earth, on January 29th, when it will be best viewed and fully illuminated by the sun, making it very good for photos. And that's it for the sky at night this Christmas time. Now back to Quinton and Maciek.
Now listeners, I don't want to scare you again, but it is time for the astronomy joke of the month. Now, Maciek, have you ever heard the astronomy joke of the month?
Nay, I must say I never had the pleasure.
Well, buckle your seatbelts, because it is, well, I'm not quite sure how to describe it, but here it is, the astronomy joke of the month.
Hello, Dan.
Hi, Michelle.
How do you fancy hearing a festive astronomy joke?
Go on, then.
Okay, drum roll, please. Why don't aliens celebrate Christmas?
I don't know, Michelle. Why don't aliens celebrate Christmas?
Because they don't like to give away their presents.
Oh, that's awful.
Oh, lordy, that was a terrible joke. I actually think part of my liver has shut down after hearing that. How are you feeling, Maciek?
I'm quite okay. I thought it was quite funny. It could have been worse. It could have been so much worse.
Well, don't worry. I'm sure if we go back through the back catalogue of astronomy jokes, there are some pretty awful ones in there as well.
To finish off the trio of new people, the victim of this month's joke was Dan Wilkins, our new sound manager.
That he was, and probably very scared now as well. Well, listeners, that's all we've got time for this month. I hope you've enjoyed listening, and we'll see you again next month.
And Merry Christmas.